Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Yeah, we're going to do hippies and hash today. I thought, let's have some fun. February, it's the dark times. It's my kids are so at the end of their ropes. It's so cabin fever where I am today. I witnessed bickering over a ukulele bag. So that's kind of, that's low stakes, right? So I know that everybody is a little bit crabby and a little bit at our wit's end. And what can we do? Let's just have some fun here today. I would almost qualify him as a friend. I'm such a fan of Jonathan Kaufman's, who I've never actually met. He's a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle and has this amazing book. It's called Hippie Food. And then to pair with that, I put together a bunch of hash recipes because hippies and hash, come on. That's hilarious. That's as good as you get in a recipe joke. It doesn't get better than that. So first off, I want you to send me your hippie food memories. 81807. Did your mom make you eat carob? My mom made me eat carob. That was horrible. It tastes like chalk. Did you have wheat germ on everything? What else? What was your hippie food? Did you have hippie food memories? Were you the hippie making your kid eat wheat germ lollipops? You know, text me, 81807. I want all those things. We also are going to have tons of time for an Ask Me Anything at the end of the show. You got any questions? You got questions about booze? You got questions about why your sister eats so many capers? Anything. I'm game. I'll just answer them all. I've got nothing to do for many segments. So I also have questions you've emailed me and or sent in on the Twitter bot. I am at Dear Dara. I will take these questions in all formats, all comers. All right, but first off, we're going deep into hippie food. He has written the book that is called Hippie Food, How Back-to-the-Landers, Longhairs, and Revolutionaries Change the Way We Eat. He's a San Francisco Chronicle reporter. He's a McAllister College grad, so he knows some things about life in the Twin Cities. And he is on the phone. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Dara. Good to talk to you again.
Oh, it's always good. I love this because you and I have the bond of hippie childhoods.
Oh, yes. The shared trauma of carob.
And tiger's milk, which I really did not, only as an adult did I ever one day just be like, wait a minute, what do those two words mean together?
Well, yeah, tiger's milk were kind of the treats, you know, despite the carob coating, it sort of was like a sweet candy bar, and we would occasionally be allowed to have them, which is very sad. That was our big treat.
All right. So, but your book is more serious. So obviously it's somewhat, it took you to really identify, but we're slightly living in the food world that the hippies made, right? Everybody's having kale bowls at lunch. Whole Foods is very distinctly built model on, you know, food co-ops and things like that. Actually has a connection to the Twin Cities that you want to talk about. But I want to go right to the point of, you know, this was a counterculture. This was a movement kind of, you know, in the shadow of the larger culture. And it didn't start with bell bottoms and love beads. Let's talk about where this kind of began.
Yeah, well, I mean, when I started doing this research into this cuisine, you know, I thought, oh, well, this is just going to go back to, you know, the 1960s and 1970s, and maybe I'll find some stuff on Haight Street. And no, not at all. There's like this 150-year history of anti-industrial food movements that the sort of and health foods that the hippies picked up on in the late 60s and 70s.
So when you say 150 years, I mean, you're putting it right. As soon as the Industrial Revolution started tugging food one way, a bunch of people were tugging food the other way.
Yeah, well, in the 1830s and 1840s, there was this vegetarian proselytizer named Sylvester Graham, who was traveling up and down the East Coast, and he was complaining about sort of the horror of meat, and he had this theory that meat and sugar and white flour would sort of dangerously overexcite the system, and so leading to to disease. And so you had to eat brown bread, and he was like he was concerned with what the industrial millers might be adulterating the flour with. And so there was a revolt of millers outside one of his talks where they threatened to kind of string him up. So that fear of what
Sorry to interrupt you. Going to say, are we talking about the man who invented the graham cracker, which is now mainly on the outside of two marshmallows and a piece of chocolate?
He didn't actually invent it, but it was definitely named after him.
So his legacy, the man who was anti-sugar and proselytizing up and down the East Coast, it lives on in our s'mores.
Just one of the many ironies about this movement.
I feel like that might go a step past irony to something a little more aggressive, but we won't discuss that too much. Okay, so it has these roots back then, and then, kept going. There was a lot of religious underpinning to hippie food by the time hippie food became hippie food.
Yeah, I mean, there were the Seventh-day Adventists who were followers of Graham, who were vegetarians and started, for 100-something years. And then there were people like the macrobiotics who were, it was sort of a vaguely spiritual, vaguely health-related movement that kind of played off, that attracted Americans interested in Japanese religions. And then, sort of the Indian spiritual pursuits led a lot of people to cook curry. So a lot of different strains there.
The curry chicken salads of the early 20th century. And very interesting. But then you talk about how actually in the Midwest and around the Twin Cities, the Dakotas, places where grange movements, cooperative banks, cooperative grain elevators, talk about how that had anything to do with anything.
Yeah, well, Minnesota has some of the most permissive or I guess supportive laws around food co-ops because they're because of all the Scandinavian co-ops that set up in the 19th century and early 20th century. And so Minnesota and the Twin Cities in particular was really one of the intellectual centers of the natural food co-op movement that sprung up in the 1970s. People all over the country were paying attention to what was happening in the Twin Cities.
I love that. And so we obviously still have the great co-op legacy today, places like Land O'Lakes.
Mm-hmm.
But then we also have all our co-ops, co-op partners, the Wedge, so many co-ops. And this, you say, this is not just accidentally somewhat like Whole Foods.
No, not at all. I mean, Whole Foods started up in Austin, but it was really modeling itself in a lot of ways after food co-ops. A food co-op there called Wheatsville that was pretty popular. They sort of took all of the ingredients and all of the sort of even things like bulk bins and organic vegetables, and then they made them bougie. And so then you didn't have to belong to the co-op. You didn't have to volunteer at Whole Foods. You could just shop. Which was really attractive to a lot of middle-class folks.
So Wheatsville. Did you ever get that, or that was before your time?
I went to the co-op in Austin, but...
Mm-hmm. Oh, and so Wheatsville is in Austin.
Oh, there's a product called Wheatsville, too?
No. Where was Wheatsville, the co-op?
Oh, Wheatsville, yeah, this was in Austin.
It was in Austin. Oh, very interesting. So it's interesting to think about. So there was this co-op movement kind of in the Twin Cities, and then there are also these restaurants. You have a long, long passage on the New Riverside Cafe.
Yeah, which I actually remember fondly from when I was a freshman and sophomore in college at McAllister. So, yeah, the new Riverside Cafe opened up in 1971, but for about 3 years, it was a restaurant that they wouldn't charge prices. There was a poster of Karl Marx near the cash register, and their motto was to each according to his own, what's his big saying?
Each according to his need.
From each according to his ability to each according to his need. Mm-hmm. And so then they didn't even pay each other wages. They used the co-op to support as the sort of the food supply, and they all lived in cooperative housing, which they paid for with the proceeds. They shared cars. They had a couple of other little businesses, including like a moving company and a car repair collective, and everything was run out of a payphone in the cafe because they didn't want to spring for a phone at first.
That's just such an interesting idea. So far, I wonder. My kids and I were at this lovely lodge up north called Madden's, and they had phone booths, and the kids were just like clustered around them, like it was at a dinosaur exhibit. They're like, and you could just go in there and you could close the door, and they went in the phone booth and they closed the door, and they just look out because they have no idea what you would do once you got in there. And I actually did see later in that trip people who wanted to have private phone calls taking their cell phones into the phone booths.
Uh-huh.
Maybe phone booths will come back, but no, they won't. All right. So we think, so that's where a lot of this current kind of Whole Foods, you know, the bins and that's where the organics movement came from, because those were the markets that, you know, supported, put the money into the system, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, there were all these back to the landers who moved from the cities, you know, mostly people in their teens and 20s. And they wanted to rid their diets of, and, you know, sort of the ecosystem of chemicals. And so they began farming organically. And they really kind of turned a very tiny fringe movement into a much larger fringe movement. And then they sort of created the restaurants and the food co-ops and the farmers markets to distribute organic food.
So there were also, you know, in addition to creating organic systems, without which I could not live. Like, so I am so grateful to the people of the, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s who fought so that I can have organic apples. Like, and it's a very easy thing. I just go and I get my organic apples. And I don't think about it. But I don't think about the enormous quantity of work that went into creating the system to allow that to be. So I'm grateful to those hippies and their works. But there have also been some excesses in the system, so shall we say. let's have some fun with, the weirdness of kind of fake health foods that have come through the system.
Like,
Tiger's milk.
Oh, Tiger's milk, Bragg's liquid amino acids, which I use.
You do?
And, yeah, and nutritional yeast I occasionally use too. It's kind of good for vegetarian stuff when you really need a little blast of flavor. But like Bragg's liquid amino acids came about in like the 30s or 40s, I think, when they had the early health food scene of the Southern California, and you know they had this theory that you had to eat foods that were vital. And so they thought that mineral salts were devitalized, and so they had all of these vegetal salts that came out that were supposedly so much better for you because they some sort of vital life energy would be conveyed.
And then there's been, you know, any number of, like, silly deep-fried tofu, you know, gravy tofu. I've got a nice text from somebody who said, when she made tofu meatloaf and then threw it away after the family's dirty look. So there's a big, big strain in America of trying to make tofu into like heritage farm foods.
Yeah, well, you know, there were so many loaves back then. It was like everything could be a loaf. Somebody sent me recently, there's like a Seventh-day Adventist loaf-making bot that you can find online. You just plug in like beans, nuts, and whatever, and it'll make you like a loaf.
That's horrible. A loaf bot. That's kind of funny to think about.
Yeah, no, I mean, it took like all of the 70s for people to figure out how to make all of these new to them foods taste good. I mean, some of the early experiments were really brown and really leaden.
They're still out there. Okay, but then you also talk in the book about how, and I didn't realize this, like I was aware that there was this kind of hippie spiritual trail where they would go to India and see each other. You know, like it would be a bunch of, 20-something Americans just kind of tramping along one particular way of getting through spiritually important districts of Asia. But then they ended up bringing back all kinds of foods, and a bunch of our restaurant culture now kind of comes from this hippie trail situation. So can you talk about, you know, that lived experience? What do you see around you in San Francisco that you're like, oh, that's hippie trail? That's for me.
You know, it sort of changed here because I think so much of the hippie Indian restaurants that opened up in like the 1970s here have all disappeared, unfortunately. I mean, there was this great restaurant that I just wish I could like travel back in time to in San Francisco called Communion, where you had to be silent. It was all vegetarian Indian food, and you had to eat silently, and then you had to bust your own tables, and you had to pay by dropping money into a pay box. And at one time, they decided they were making too much of a profit, so they lowered their prices.
Aw, I never want to go there. That sounds...
They did not stick around very long.
That's a complicated thing. That I don't like kind of penance food. I don't like the stripped down food of suffering. It's not my thing. Yeah. I'm not into suffering.
Yeah, so many people told me that they were just determined to not eat white bread, and so they were going to eat the opposite. So there was we are going to eat. It was so reactionary that flavor was not important at first.
Oh, we got a text. Someone had to drink something called pep up drink. Mom made us drink it daily. The recipe was in the book. Let's eat right to stay fit. That sounds...
Adele Davis. Oh, her smoothies sounded disgusting. They would be like skim milk with molasses, brewer's yeast, wheat germ, and sometimes an egg.
So that's that strain that says like if it tastes good, it's something wrong with it. Food should be literally like hold your nose medicine.
Right.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so one of the things that you talk about in the book is that the hippies kind of don't get the respect. Now, even when I say that, like I just pictured so many cliches in the culture of, long hair, bell bottom. Like, it's hard to pay hippies respect, but we should respect our hippie forebears more.
Oh, yeah. I mean, to me, they completely changed the way we think about and talk about food 50 years on. I mean, their idea of what healthy food was, whole grains, lots of fruits and vegetables, less meat, less processed sugars, eating sort of without, eating, foods that don't have a lot of chemicals in them, that's become kind of the national idea of what healthy food is, whether we eat it or not. And then they created the organic movement, or sort of gave it life. They, they introduced all of these foods into the sort of the mainstream American palate. I think they did. They did a lot.
All right, they did a lot. Thank you to our hippies of the past. Yeah, I love all. You know, there's a still in the Twin Cities. Some of the restaurants get their stuff from, these just very committed back to the landers who have been, making their small farm awesome for 25 years, and they make my life better, so I like them. All right, Mr. Kaufman, you are coming to town in the spring, right?
I am. Well, June 7th.
June
so it's,
7th.
So, yeah, I'm going to be at Majors & Quinn.
With me.
And
we're going to be
you.
Chatting. We're going to see this.
All right.
Live at Majors & Quinn. Well, I will have you back on the show right before then, get people excited about it. And
awesome.
Thank you for doing this today.
Oh, thanks for talking to me.
Oh, very fun. I was happy to go down this. I feel better about, I had some, I think, residual anger about too many carob-coated raisins and stuff. And you get carob-coated raisins.
So horrible.
Yeah, and you just have this feeling like, everybody else has a good life, and I have carob-coated raisins. And your book made me feel better about that. It made me say, like, oh, this was just an excess of a truly good movement.
Yeah, I kind of forgave my parents and everybody around them for some of the food that I'd eaten while doing the research as well.
Oh, funny. All right. Thank you for helping me in my healing journey. All right. When we come back, I'm going to talk about hash. So stick around for that. That recipe, that book is called Hippie Food, How Back to the Landers, Long Hairs, and Revolutionaries Have Changed the Way We Eat. It's by Jonathan Kaufman. Jonathan Kaufman has a website, which is jonathankaufman.com. He's one of those people that doesn't use the H in Jonathan. Jonathan Kaufman, Hippie Food. Really fun. You got some carob issues you need to work out? This is the book that will help you move past it. Move past your deep trauma with the carob raisins, such as I might have had. It's 28 degrees. Looks like the snow is gone for today. Maybe some more on Monday on Washington's birthday. And this weather is brought to you by the Minnesota History Center. They do such good stuff over there. Yeah. All right, so I've got, what should we do now? Should we do the recipes? Should we answer questions? Let's just answer a couple questions. Oh, it's fun. The text line is filling up with memories of childhood. Oh, I've got a good one. The former King Midas flour mill in Hastings was started in 1853 by Harrison H. Graham, a relative of Sylvester Graham, the cracker man. So, oh, that's good. Little Minnesota Graham cracker, vegetarian, proselytizer connection. Thank you for sending that in. So I've got a text that came in. My parents used to, back in the 60s, make me drink cod liver oil. Yeah, that was a big strain. And this is going to sound crazy, but they were right. They were right. That cod liver oil is full of vitamin D. And we of the North, we cannot get enough vitamin D from sunlight this time of year. Our ability to get enough vitamin D from sunlight ends sometime in about October, and it picks back up in the spring. But that was the best way to get vitamin D at the time. So even though that's a gross, yucky thing and no doubt a traumatic memory, it was really good for your brain. I make my kids have vitamin D gummies. So obviously the kids today are living a soft life when they're just sitting around having a gummy when you had to have cod liver oil. So I sort of have sympathies for you, but maybe we'll frame it in a better scene. I also am a big fan of old Tom and Jerry cartoons, and wow, cod liver oil is a staple. So I think that's kind of funny. The 1930s, you know, people didn't even know what vitamins were. This until the 20th century. One of my things that I do when I'm not doing anything else is figuring out when people identified rickets, when they identified beriberi, things like that. It must have been an amazing time to just, a new vitamin was coming along every once in a while. So I got a comment from hippies who made great food to talking about hash. It is now baby boomer radio. All right. Now, if I am a certified Gen Xer, but yeah, so we'll talk about those hash recipes when we come back. It's just kind of fun going through all everybody's memories. I got one on the Twitter bot, someone who also grew up with Tiger's Milk, which was like a white candy bar, kind of made from, I think it's made from, I should have asked Jonathan Kaufman when we had him on the line. It was made in the, I pulled up Wikipedia. So it was basically made of milk powder and sugar, and then it had a bunch of other stuff in it. And it was such, anyway, so the Twitter comment I got was that it was just such a sugar rush. It really was, those Tiger Milk bars. And it's kind of funny. I've seen so many the kind of new things that are in that Tiger's Milk vein. You know, you see, I got these cauliflower puffs the other day at a kind of a health foodie place, and it said on the bag, cauliflower puff. And of course, I'm very interested in cauliflower and all permutations. So I get this thing, and I'm not paying attention. I don't really look too much at it until I get home. I get at it at home. And they're just cheese puffs. You know the generic cheese puffs you get from Old Dutch? So they're just like a puff. And then instead of having cheese on them, the ingredient list basically starts with sorghum flour. And then, you know, the fourth or something thing on there is cauliflower powder. So you get as much cauliflower from a cheese doodle that's flavored with cauliflower as you would get calcium from Cheetos. Like, it's the same. It's just nonsense. It's insanity. So there's, I'm just curious about fake health foods at all times. So I had a fun time showing my kids the label, and then we read it, and then we said, this is not cauliflower. Beware of fake product information trying to get vegetables into you. And that ended that. All right, we're going to come back. We're going to talk breakfast hash because I love it. And all corned beef is showing up in the stores as a preparatory to St. Patrick's Day. And I know that you love corned beef hash because I have a tap into your mind, and I can just see that you kind of love corned beef hash. But if you don't, I also will have a trout hash, some other things. And we'll get to all that when we come back.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
It's time to talk about hash. Yeah, we're segueing from hippies to hash. But, you know, breakfast hash, everybody's favorite. You love it. You want a bunch of skillet potatoes, don't you? It's kind of skillet potatoes weather. It's get warmed up. So as always, these are up there at WCCO.com/menu. It looks so good there. Look at all the pictures. I love the internet fairies that make this all come together like a magical, sparkling joy. And number five is trout hash. Yeah, I know. Maybe you don't eat meat. Maybe you just, maybe it's Lent, because it is. So I think you could make some good Lake Superior smoked trout breakfast hash. And do this. And then you can put all of the, it's good. It's fishy and potato-y. It's a good thing. Trout hash. Doesn't sound right. Tastes right. Number four, ham hash. Well, you know what else I was doing this week when I wasn't doing anything else? I was figuring out how the pigs got to Ireland. They walked over a land bridge when there was still a land bridge connecting them to Europe. And so pork was the big food of Ireland. It wasn't beef until much, much, much later. There are all of these piles of pig bones from the caveman era Irish. So always there was pork in Ireland since there was a land bridge. That's how long. So anyway, so I think that you can make a ham hash because that is a really delicious thing and kind of inexpensive. And that's all. It's great. It's historically relevant. Now you know about the pigs walking this land bridge. Think about it. That's a weird thing to think about, a land bridge connecting the UK and Europe. It's weird. It's just totally weird. All right, number three, spicy chipotle bacon corned beef hash. You know I love these kind of fusion things with all-American recipes that kind of just come from our great toss salad of immigration that we have here. So this is a kind of a combination. It's got some like a corned beef hash with chipotle chilies and adobo. It's spicy. This is also dinner. I think you make this and then you have it for dinner, and that's really good. Number two, a vegetarian, another meatless one. This would be Martha Stewart, the great and good Martha, with her spinach and egg potato hash. She has a really nice, even if you don't make this, you might look at it if you're kind of nuts about food. Because what she does is she takes the hash, she makes little wells in it with a spoon, kind of digs out a little nesty area, puts the eggs in there, and then cooks it. Now the eggs are in the pan with the, I love it. So smart. She's so smart. Love that, Martha. She learned a lot in her life. All right, so then what's my number one? Yep, I'm making a prison reference. It's a deep track. I think she just knows a lot of things, though. She knows how to do things that are very beautiful. She knows how to do things that are very tasty. Also, she survived prison, so we got to give it to Martha. My goodness. All right, so my number one hash recipe, which you can find up at the WCCO.com, is corned beef hash. So, of course, it's corned beef hash. You know I'm a classicist. I like the classics. So the most important thing to me about corned beef hash is that you need good corned beef And then you need that really good cast iron pan. I love my vintage cast iron pans. I haven't talked to you about this enough lately. I should. It's all I cook with. I love them. They are so heavy. They hold heat so well. They get a really good crust on the potatoes and the onions. Yeah, they're very heavy and kind of a pain in that way, but they're worth it. And you just make your corned beef hash in your big heavy pan. You're living the good life. You cannot get better than that. I'm convinced of it. All right, when we come back, we are going to have a very luxurious and lovely Ask Me Anything segment. So you got a question? Send it in. You can find me on the Twitter bot, at Dear Dara. You can text it, 81807. I will answer your questions when we're back. Dara here. Oh, my goodness. Someone is reading my mind. I got a question that says, hey, Dara, any chance we'll trend towards more vegan destinations in the Twin Cities in 2018? Yes, I am reporting something on this right now that isn't quite made it. You'll see it in print in about a month. But that Route to Rise, that place is looking for a brick and mortar. And they do, like, they're kind of famous for their mac and cheese vegan egg rolls, and then Pop-Tarts. They're looking for a brick-and-mortar space. And then Reverie, which was a well-known vegan place that lasted for about 2 years. They say that they're going to have something in 2018. So, yeah, we're going to have a couple. All right, we got somebody on the line. Somebody who wants to ask me a question in life. So, what do we got? Ron. Welcome to the show. Ron, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dara. Happy Saturday.
Oh, happy Saturday to you. It's a good one.
Hey, I live in Uptown here right behind Punch Pizza and Barnes & Noble here on the Greenway.
Oh, by the good Rustica.
Yes.
You live large.
Big time. You got to do what you got to do in the Twin Cities. I've asked so many people this question. I even went into the new apartment complex here. Next door to Rustica, the little mall there. What do you know? What's going on in the old Triggs? It's supposed to open up in April. Everybody's tight-lipped about it. And what would you like to see going there? What are we lacking here in the Twin Cities, especially Minneapolis, as far as a cuisine? And I know what I think, but what's your two cents?
Oh well, let's see. In that part of town. Well, first of all, I don't know what's actually happening. I mean, I know what everybody knows, which is that there's a real estate development company called Trammell Crow, and they're coming, and they haven't said what they're doing. And so until they do, here we are in the dark. But and they bought another place in Edina, so they're building multiple locations. Hey, Trammell Crow, if you're listening, call me up. I got ideas for you. I would say that with the Vecchio's being missing at this point, like an affordable Italian place would do really well. Just a classic, good, affordable, though. I want to say affordable. Like, I don't think that the Twin Cities can support any more of these $40 plate restaurants. And you may say to yourself, Dara, isn't that your bread and butter? Isn't what you do get paid to review $40 plate restaurants? That's just like what comes down the pike. I cover what's news. So if people open a bunch of $40 plate restaurants and I have to go to try them, but I don't think that's what anybody wants. Everything I see that's popular, really, entree prices are coming in at $10-$12. So what do I think would be great in that space?
Yeah.
Affordable Italian. And what do you think? I feel like I'm playing a game show. Like, what was behind that curtain?
Well, first of all, I don't think we have good quality restaurants here in my little general area. Maybe Urban Eatery, they're okay. But it's really, I like to see a good, affordable, good quality, homemade Mexican, Mexican.
That is never what giant developers put in. They never do. And it's a bad thing for cities. I know about this because when they do those leases for the, you know, ground floor of a very expensive place, they want their money guaranteed. And so that's why you end up only with corporations, because they want the lease guaranteed for 10 years or 20 years. And you have to show that you have the assets to pay that lease for 20 years. And then this is stupid logic, because what happens is that you can show that you have the lease for 20 years, that you have the assets for that lease for 20 years. But you, at that point, you're also a giant corporation who can just decide to shut down, declare bankruptcy. Remember when we had that, what was it? The Block E, the big pharmacy chain? Like, that's exactly what happened. Block E decided, nope, we're only making smart decisions. We're only going to have tenants that can cover our costs for 20 years. And every one of those just walked away under legal cover.
Dara, how about a Big Bowl concept?
Ooh, I love Big Bowl. Big Bowl's a good one. That's a virtuous chain. I like that place. That would be good. I don't know.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, let's do it. Well, thanks for calling in.
And
I'll probably see you at whatever it turns out to be.
Sounds good, Dara. Thanks.
All right, so I got some other questions on the text line. What is the best traditional chicken parmesan? My fave so far is DiGidio's. Other recommendations? Well, first of all, DiGidio's is a treasure. That's a place that has been open in St. Paul on the east side since the Depression, basically. Opened right after. And I can't say enough good things about DiGidio's. I've had high-end chicken parmesan. I feel like I've had it actually at Mucci's, same neighborhood. But I don't know. You put DiGidio's in my mind, and I can't argue with that. That's perfect. So maybe try Mucci's. And let me think about the rest of it. I just remember that I was fighting with someone who was telling me that that this place had a really good chicken parmesan, and then I was arguing that it wasn't. But I'm blanking on what that was. All right, so I've got another question. Do I have any ideas for cooking grass-fed steaks? They always seem to be tough. I know the answer to this. I've fought this battle, and I won, and I come to you with the answer. This is how you do it. To do a grass-fed steak, you need to get really high, blisteringly high heat, and then you put it on there very briefly. So you're doing crazy high heat for just like minutes. You know, I don't know how thick the steak is. So just enough to get the outside very crisp, ridiculous. And then you bring it to the lowest heat. So when you're doing this on a grill, you know, you make a fire on one side, you put the steak on the fire, and then you move it away. If you're doing it on a stovetop, you know, I've actually just cooked it really, really in a really hot pan, thrown it in there, one side, other side, and then just turned off the heat and let it just kind of do its thing in there just with its residual heat for a long time. So very hot, then very low. That's how you do a grass-fed steak. I've got a text from somebody who has a recipe for a pot roast, and they want them to just put the pot roast on the oven rack. That sounds crazy to me. I don't think I even understand. Like, if you're saying you're going to take your chuck roast and just put it on the oven rack, that is going to drip. I don't even know what we're talking about. If the question is you're putting it in a cast iron, you know, thing, and you're putting that just in the oven, absolutely, that works great. You can use your oven instead of a slow, in place of a slow cooker. I actually kind of like it more sometimes. So that's an option. Now I've got Mr. Dan Cook has got a look on his face. Do we have someone on the line or no? I'm just imagining things. So yeah, if the issue is put your chuck roast just on the oven rack, that's a recipe for disaster. Don't do that, and be very questioning of where that came from. That person is possibly pranking you or your worst enemy. And if the issue is, you know, you're putting your Dutch oven just right in the oven, yeah, that works. All right, so another question came in. Why are so many women up for the Beard Awards this year? Well, that directly relates to my column on this at Minneapolis St. Paul Magazine, mspmag.com. You kind of see the whole list, but Jamie Malone, Michelle Geyer, Diane Yang. We have so many female nominees are on the long list. So what happens is the long list, and then it'll get trimmed, and then that'll be the real nominee pool. But I think it's just coincidence. I think it just so happened that Jamie Malone at Grand Cafe, which is seriously one of the best restaurants in the Twin Cities right now, that Jamie Malone opened her restaurant. And that happens to be this year. And people are just buzzing about it, as well they should. So I think, and then the fact that Christina Nguyen opened Hi Hi, and she's on the long list. That Hi Hi in Northeast, that's the best Vietnamese restaurant we've ever had in the Twin Cities. I mean, in terms of like chefy fancy stuff. We will now, I think, have a bifurcation where we'll have classic old Vietnamese places, you know, as DiGidio's, as the classic old Italian, you know, so will, gosh, Quang Deli be a classic old Vietnamese place. And then we're going to have a couple of chef, you know, chefy people came out of that culture, want to do more exciting things. And Hi Hi will be the first of that. So that's why. I just think it's coincidence. And I'll be curious to see if the great number of women on the long list end up being a equivalently great number proportion of women on the short list. So, but, you know, celebrate it. It's getting to be a better industry. It was tougher 10 years ago, extremely tough 20 years ago, and, you know, tending in the right direction. So I feel good about that. All right, next week we have a real-life coffee farmer. I was reading a story about how there's a kind of a gold rush now with climate warming that we're going to have California-grown coffee. We've talked about that before, about the very few coffee trees in Florida. So I want to talk to a real coffee farmer. I am made of coffee. Nothing else happens too much with me. But that's what we'll have next week. Until then, it's a sloppy season. Cabin fever is real. Tempers are short. Be patient with yourself. And I will see you here next week on Off the Menu.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.